Here Be Monsters, the podcast about
the BS under the hood.
The podcast about
the unknown.
This must have been a hard decision for you.
It was very much so, Bob, and I appreciate your comments. And I did, and it was something that I had to think about. And I started to think about the future of the Senate and what had transpired. It wasn't what I had been accustomed to in building bipartisan bridges. And I felt I could be a more effective voice on the outside.
This is Olympia Snow on Face the Nation talking about her resignation from the United States Senate. Snow is a Republican senator from Maine. Earlier in 2012, Snow wrote this really strongly worded open letter about the nature of politics in this country. In this letter, she refers to Congress as a body that, quote, habitually eschews full debate and an open amendment process in favor of competing up or down, take it or leave it proposals.
To compromise.
Well, what has gone wrong? I mean, when I came to Washington, people compromised. Now it's a dirty word. When did that happen?
Well, you know, it's a good question. It happened, unfortunately, very rapidly. And somehow people think that compromising is capitulating in your principles. You couldn't be far from it. People understand you get a soft...
Being a moderate in today's political climate is pretty difficult, as we just saw in these ultra-partisan elections that seem to reduce every single issue down to a solid blue and red. But Olympia Snow wasn't the only person on Capitol Hill to defect this year.
When we've gotten to the point where your partisan stripe comes before your American citizenship, our shared culture, our shared values in this country, then we have a real problem at the national, federal level.
Andrea Seabrook is an award-winning journalist who covered politics for many years at National Public Radio. In July of 2012, she tendered her resignation to NPR, citing a frustration with America's elected officials, saying that she was being, quote, lied to every day, all day. So today on the show, we're going to talk to Andrea Seabrook about that decade and a half that she spent working at the nation's capital. She'll tell us about the brickwalling, the secrecy, the rhetoric that dictates American political coverage. And she'll also tell us about the project that's been keeping her busy post-NPR, a podcast called Decode DC, which aims to help regular citizens understand what's actually going on in the halls of Congress. Hey, Andrea, are you recording right now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I really want to know is, why did you leave? Like, what's wrong with our system?
Yeah. Nothing that's happening or seems to be happening today is actually what's going on. Really, my jadedness is with the news itself, with media, with the definition of it. I began to feel that covering what all those press conferences and stuff was actually, all of that was just a red herring, that it's theater with the purpose of distracting us from the real story underneath. And so I felt like every time I covered a basic news story that everyone else, to be fair, was covering because it's quote unquote the news of the day, I was actually doing the congressman's bidding by being their mouthpiece for, you know, the stupid sideshow instead of the real story, which is, you know, the actual corruption of our process. And I don't mean just corruption as graft, but just a breakdown of our governance in this country. And then I tried to figure out a lot of ways around that, and eventually came to a place where I decided I had to leave and start my own news organization, basically, to instill those values in my reporting.
What is the Capitol actually like to be in? Because my only real perception of it is what I have seen on the news and heard on the radio.
It's very echoey and can be very cold, but it also has all these fireplaces And so it often smells like wood smoke, which I love. Some things that people don't know is that you go down below the first floor into the main basement, that most of the staff and lawmakers spend a lot of time walking around down there, and it's all painted sort of institutional battleship gray, and all of the cables, phone, electricity, internet, everything, security, that have ever been laid since, you know, 1900 or 1850 are all strung along the ceilings in the basement and then go up to the upper floors. And so you walk along these gray corridors that, you know, that almost look like a dorm room because they've been painted that color gray. And there are these like giant 2 foot round bundles of wire that are strung in the ceiling above your head, all different kinds of wires, a big fat mess. And there's like a carry out where you can get fried chicken on Wednesdays, or, you know, some kind of soup on the Senate side, and there's boiler rooms and, guys walking around with dollies and shirts that say Bob in the corner. And, you know, there's like a whole working city, part of the Capitol that you don't ever see on the news. Another thing you never see on the news is that on the floors of the House and Senate, which are broadcast by C-SPAN, and that feed is often recorded and used in the news, the chambers are almost always empty. Empty. Maybe a couple of people on the dais calling roll. But during a debate on the House floor, there are usually maybe 10 people in the giant room of the 435 people plus staff and interns and pages that there could be on the floor. But the cameras, all of the camera work done is recorded by the House and Senate television studios, which are owned by the Congress itself. And that there's only one feed that comes out of those. And so the networks don't even have the power to pan the camera around and show you there's no one there. The cameras are all run by people who are staff, and they put, when there's a debate on, they put, you know, take close-ups of the people's face who are talking so that you can't see that the place is empty.
Are you saying that, like, all these sessions where, like, legislation is decided, there's no one there for those?
Yeah. Now, you have to be there in person to vote. So when there is a vote, suddenly hundreds and hundreds of people pour onto the floor with these little credit card-like things that they stick into a slot, vote yes or no. There are two buttons, actually three buttons. There's a green one, a red one, and a yellow one, and the yellow one is to vote present. They all vote, and then they all leave again. When the actual sort of discussion of the legislation at hand is going on, really most anything else, there's almost no one there. This is absolutely true of both chambers, the House and the Senate.
What are people doing? Are they just like back in their office playing Tetris? Or
there's often committee meetings. I don't know. Most lawmakers are either in their office doing business work there. Somebody in the office might have the TV on the debate that they're ostensibly taking part in. You know, most lawmakers have to raise about $10,000 a day for their reelection campaign. That's starting the day after their previous reelection campaign. So they spend many, many hours a day, oftentimes at fundraisers with lobbyists, meeting big donors, sitting at phone banks outside buildings that are run by the parties that have these phone banks where they can call donors all day long or for a few hours every day to raise money for their reelection campaigns.
This made me a little bit mad. Like, I don't understand how we can claim to live in a democracy if people are skipping out on the actual conversations they're supposed to be having with other lawmakers, right?
Well, the truth is, the way the system works right now, by the time something gets to the floor, its fate is almost always, you know, predetermined. the bill, no majority party would bring a bill to a floor that might fail. So they've already worked out with the president or the other party or whoever they have to negotiate with a bill that that can get the certain, you know, the numbers needed, the votes needed to pass. And so by the time the bill comes to the floor, the debate's over. Nothing that actually happens on the floor affects the vote on the thing. It's just a show of it's a show of democracy. It's the democracy show with the House and Senate.
Oh no. Do you think that there is a concerted effort to mislead people?
There are most certainly very cynical strategies that go on up there about making sure voters don't see the guts of what's going on all the time. There are certainly talking points and stratagem to make sure that the message going out to the voters has nothing to do with the BS under the hood. So in that sense, yes, I believe it is a concerted effort. In fact, I know it is a concerted effort to mislead people. And on the other hand, I think a lawmaker might tell themselves something like, well, all this fundraising and all this, you know, these meetings I have all day with lobbyists about what they want and the fact that I let lobbyists write, this is actually, you know, this is actually in the service of those voters, but they're not really interested in hearing about that. So I'm going to talk to them about, you know, the big issues and just keep this stuff to myself.
Has anyone ever lied straight to your face and expected you to report it?
Absolutely. Politicians are incredibly adept at not telling lies that are sort of reportable because they go through campaigns. And so they're, you know, these campaigns, if they said anything that seems counter to any fact you could point to or even opinion you could point to, then they would get raked over the coals during the campaign. So what the kinds of lies they tell you when you're a reporter in the Capitol is things like, I'm voting for this because my constituents want me to. We're not going to re-up the assault weapons ban because Americans deserve freedom. If you unpack that, they're making, you know, this bullshit moral argument that has nothing to do with reality. You know, we know that the real reason why they're not extending the assault weapons ban, even though it's overwhelmingly popular in the American public, is because one of their biggest contributors is from the NRA, and they have to run for election again, and the NRA puts a lot of money in their election coffers. So it's that kind of lie, the kind of, you know, where you're just thinking in your head, God, could you just say something honest for once? I mean, what a bunch of horse hockey, you know? Being in the Capitol is a funny thing as a journalist. So somebody will say, oh, the speaker's having a press conference. And all of the journalists in the Capitol, or at least a few from every news organization, will run and point their cameras and microphones at the same person and record the tape of the exact same thing. Then they'll all run back to their offices and report essentially the same story on their own news organizations, and then compete against each other to either get it on their air 20 seconds faster or have some access to the lawmakers that the other ones don't have. There's no real attempt to cover something else than the line that is being fed to the press by the politicians on both sides. If journalists could say, you know what, that's actually not the news, it's not the important thing for my listeners, my viewership, whatever, to hear today about what's going on, then it would utterly change everything up there. Because the only reason those press conferences and so on occur is because they are covered the way they are covered by media. So, you know, the key is in some ways are in our hands. We can't keep covering it the same way and expect them to do anything different.
Could you identify what the problem is? What's at the root of everything here? Is it money?
Yeah, money is one of the problems. hesitate to say the problem is money, because that leads you very quickly down the path of public financing of elections, which I don't necessarily think is the right answer. It could be an answer, but I am not sold by it at all, personally, or professionally. I guess I would have to say the problem is much broader and more philosophical. It's that we aren't watching. We aren't watching what they do closely enough. So that could mean we don't have enough controls on the money, and a lot of dark money can be spent, which is absolutely true. It can mean that we don't have, you know, mandatory reporting of how that money is spent, which is also true in many cases. It could mean that there aren't enough reporters covering the right things, which is also true. It could mean that we don't have a level of education and civic awareness in this country to be able to understand how important these things are, which is also true. And I think those things all combine together to make it a really dark and difficult time in American politics. I won't say it's the worst it's ever been, because we don't have people, you know, beating each other with canes in the halls of Congress, and that has happened. But I think it's one of the most disheartening times for representation in our government.
Did you ever raise these concerns with NPR?
Yes.
And what did they say?
My editors at NPR, most of the time agreed with me wholeheartedly. And they would have loved any of the stories that I have done and will do for Decode DC. They're always very supportive of my point of view, and I think agreed with me. They just wanted me to do those after I did the news of the day. And I got to a point, after a decade in the Capitol, that I wasn't willing to do it anymore. But, you know, personally, I couldn't stomach, you know, being colluding, basically, in a broken process.
So how did you come up with the idea for Decode DC then?
You know, I was pretty rash about leaving NPR. It's crazy, because I had, you know, what I call the best job in journalism. I came to a decision one morning and went in and resigned. So I said, I think I can freelance, or, you know, I think I'll be okay. And then I woke up in the middle of the night one night, literally. I mean, it sounds like a, you know, a stupid cliche, but I woke up at 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. one night, and the phrase Decode DC was in my head. And I picked up my laptop and I looked at the, if anyone owned the URL and the Twitter handle and the Facebook, you know, page, and no one had ever registered anything like that. So I registered them all and closed my laptop and went back to sleep. I knew what I was going to do next, but it was sort of terrifying, but, you know, it was really a good example of jumping off a cliff and growing wings on the way down.
Yeah, see, like, that's the thing that I get excited about with your project. Now you aren't tied to a news organization, so you can have full editorial oversight to talk about things that might seem obvious if you've lived on Capitol Hill for a long time. But to someone like me, who's never been east of Mississippi, I had no idea, you know?
Yeah, it's funny. This late, in both the first episode of the show, which I call the House of Misrepresentatives, it's about all the ways the House of Representatives doesn't really represent the American people. And then the third episode of the show with Ruth Roman Mars, it's about staging, political staging. When I told friends who are in the business in Washington about those two shows, their reaction was, well, don't people just know that already? Don't they know that 44% of the House is millionaires? Don't they know that 17% is women, you know? But every story that I do tries to put information into people's hands, people's brains, to help them understand better the situation, the reality of it, and to show them what they can do that would be different.
So what do you think some of those solutions are?
I think we have to wake up to the fact that we are being sold narratives all the time, and that the universe of ideas for how to move forward in any given situation and with any given problem is much, much larger than the one we are handed, the choice between McDonald's and Burger King that we are offered. You know, the world is not as it is defined by two political parties. And if we can get people to understand that, then those politicians are going to have to adapt to a new, smarter, more discriminating electorate. And that's a vast goal. Part of my goal personally is just to put these stories out there for even just my own colleagues to hear. As I feel like those, you know, choosing to do it differently has ripples throughout the system. And those ripples could make subtle changes to how other journalists cover the place, how skeptical they are of the press conferences they're sitting in.
I mean, what about this, like, feeling of helplessness that it's easy to get in a country of 300 million, you know? It's like, if you change 100 people's minds, like, what dent is that going to have when you're up against a bunch of people with a bunch of really smart lawyers and a bunch of politicians who are more interested in their next campaign fundraiser than their constituents?
Yeah, it seems too big, and they seem too powerful. I recognize that. But Americans have always managed to topple too big and too powerful, eventually. Ideas grow, they're viral, and they can't be controlled the way lawmakers would like them to be controlled. That's why I spend so much time trying to pound against the red team, blue team view of the world. Because once you buy a party, it's done. You don't, you know, you're sort of are shut off to, you sort of become a member of a team and an opponent of another one. And most importantly, you shut yourself off to anything that doesn't quite fit into that one party's ideals. And that only serves the parties. It doesn't serve us. And so, you know, despite the fact that one party might have a good idea about this or that, or the better idea in a choice of two, there's so much more. And it can change. It can change in a big way. I think it will. I think that we just need to convince people not to drink the Kool-Aid of the parties that there are. Go ahead and vote for them if you want to, but don't, you know, don't be them. And then those parties have to do a whole lot more to win our votes than just walk up and say, I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican. I mean, I know this all sounds terrible and scary and cynical and horrible, and to some extent it is. It's as bad as you think it is. It's worse. But people aren't dumb. That's why the voters aren't dumb. And that's why the lawmakers have to spend, and the parties have to spend so much time hiding what's actually going on. And so if we can, you know, circumvent that hiding and actually get information out there, I do believe people will expect more of their representation in Washington, and that itself will change the way it works.
Do you have any favorite stories from your time working on Capitol Hill?
So one of my favorite stories is about Nancy Pelosi, about the time I interviewed her. She told me a story. I love this story. It says something about, it's like a beautiful, scary story. So this is a woman who has risen to political power that women have never had. And that is as the Speaker of the House of Representatives, one of the top three politicians or elected officials in the United States. When she was a kid in high school, she was in a debate class, and she and a friend were on a team. And they had to pull debate topics out of a fishbowl. And so they, you know, put their hand in and pulled out a little piece of paper. And on the piece of paper up for debate was this phrase, "Do women think?" And to me, that reminds me of how far we have come. The issues of today, I mean, it deepens my respect for her, and it reminds me that the issues of the day today look difficult and thorny and horrible, but we have made great strides in, especially when it comes to civil rights for Americans, and 17% representation in Congress for women is ridiculous, and it's also great.
Yeah. Well, if someone wants to hear more about your ideas and listen to the program, how could they find it?
Oh, they could go to decodedc.com. It's all there. You can find links there to our iTunes feed. You know, you can subscribe to the podcast. You can look at some of the things we've written. You can listen to the stories right there, served up from SoundCloud. And you can contact us. There's a discussion forum there, and we love to hear from people.
Wonderful. Well, I'll link that up on our page too. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me. It was a long interview.
Thanks, Dad. It was really fun.
Again, Andrea Seabrook is the producer of Decode DC, which is a podcast. I'm reading here from the website. It's a podcast for smart, engaged, and busy people like you. Through the podcast and blog, Decode DC will decipher Washington's Byzantine language and procedure, sweeping away what doesn't matter so you can focus on what does. And I can't highly recommend this podcast enough. It's real great stuff. Over at decodedc.com. The show today was produced by myself, Jeff Entman, and you heard music from Swamp Dog and The Black Spot. One piece of exciting news that I have is that Here Be Monsters now has its own domain name. As you might remember, before you had to get to it through this kind of dark corner of my personal website, now that's not the case anymore. You can just type in hbmpodcast.com into your browser, and it'll take you over to this pink and yellow and blue website that I designed. You can really tell that I designed it. It's kind of embarrassing. In any case, again, that's hbmpodcast.com. where you can find all the archive of our old shows and contact information and much more, all over hbmpodcast.com. And there's a great show coming out next week, so be sure to stay tuned for that. It's all about drugs and outer space and children's stories. I think you might really like it. But in the meantime, if you want more things monstrous, be sure to check us out on Facebook and on iTunes, and there's an RSS feed that you can subscribe to too, if you're into that. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.